Hello and welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and today's guest is Isabel Foxen-Duke. Isabel basically helps women stop feeling crazy around food, and we unpack that idea in this conversation. We also talk about what it means to feel crazy, why she uses that phrase, but essentially, if you are, quote, a points-counting, scale-weighing, crazy person around food, and if you're like 90% of dieters or a chronic emotional eater, if you're a binge eater to boot, then Isabel is your person. In this conversation, we dive into diet, dieting, weight, old brain thinking patterns. We talk about social norms. We talk about all of that stuff. And it's really good. Isabel's brilliant. She actually has studied meditation in Japan. She studied transpersonal psychology in Bali. She has a website called stopfightingfood.com that is a free video training program if you're looking for new perspectives on binge eating, emotional eating, any other kind of food issue. And this conversation is really good. I think it's going to help a lot of people. I think that it is a conversation that needs to happen. This follows up on the podcast that I did with my new BFF for Evs, Sarah Sepora, in which we talked about the distinction between health and weight. This person, Isabel Foxen-Duke, came up by a random commenter on Facebook that said, "Hey, dude, you have to interview this woman." And I was like, okay, never heard of her, but let's do it. So it's an example, again, of me trying to use this platform to basically cannonball into uncomfortable conversations that are definitely outside of my pay grade and around topics that I really don't fully grasp or understand. And my intention is to approach these conversations with compassionate inquiry and curiosity and humility to try to learn some stuff. And I hope by that process, you also will learn some things too. Because I think these conversations are the ones that we need to have, the uncomfortable ones that I think could reach and affect lots of people. So with that said, check out Isabel Foxen-Duke on Instagram. I've included links to that in the show notes, as well as her various websites. And there's free videos online. You can check her out. Anyway, I'm rambling. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing this. Thanks for the 5-star reviews. Every bit helps. And without further ado, here is Isabel Foxen-Duke. This episode is brought to you by Cured Nutrition. Cured is the leader in CBD supplementation with an entire line of products designed to take your everyday life to its ultimate potential. Their daily staples are formulated with an in-house clinical herbalist, which has taken the traditional CBD regimen to an entirely new level of optimization. If you're anything like me, you like waking up feeling good and living well. You've probably toyed around with the idea of finding healthy alternatives to jumpstart your morning. Personally, it's why I start my day with Cured Rise, which is their focus supplement. It's a powerhouse blend of functional mushrooms like lion's mane and cordyceps, broad spectrum CBD, and powerful adaptogens. Gives me clean, clear, and sustained energy without any of the caffeine jitters or crash that I get with coffee. After I get going, Aura is next. It's another blend of functional mushrooms, CBD, and adaptogens, but it's got a twist. We all know how important it is to sustain our immunity nowadays, and this covers all of my bases. The vitamin D, prebiotics, crucial antioxidants are delivered straight to the gut, which is the foundation of our emotional and physical health. Am I right? Second brain. It's where the majority of our serotonin production and immune function begin, or it keeps everything in check, performing at its best. So I have one less thing to worry about, and I obviously cannot forget Zen. I use it every night. It is certainly why it has become Cure's number one selling relaxation and sleep product. You know the long nights spent tossing and turning? Yeah, not with this stuff. It has ingredients like reishi mushroom, ashwagandha, magnesium, passion flower, broad spectrum CBD. So thankfully, restlessness is something of the past. Cured Nutrition products are your answer for a daily dose of health. Visit curednutrition.com. That's C-U-R-E-D nutrition.com. Be sure to use the coupon code LOVEBOMBS, and at the checkout, you will save 10% off your order. All right. Isabel Foxen Duke, welcome to the podcast. Stoked to talk to you. We got connected because a random human on Facebook said, you should totally have Isabel Foxen Duke on your podcast. And I Googled you and was like, all right. And I emailed and here we are.
But, well, very grateful to that human. Sounds like, yeah, I'm super excited to get to do this. So thank you.
Yeah. And so for those who have never heard of you, Isabel Foxen Duke, like, who are you? How do you describe yourself? What's your deal?
So I've had the same like kind of tagline, I guess, if you want to call it that, since I started doing this work almost a decade ago, which is like, which literally is just, I help women stop feeling crazy around food. Women, feminine identified people, generally speaking, I help them stop feeling crazy around food. I help folks stop, you know, diet binge cycling, obsessing about food, feeling guilty and shameful about their body or what they're eating, all of the noise that we just get culturally around food, especially as women, but increasingly this is affecting men and all gendered people as well. You know, that is, it's a problem that I think that we don't talk enough about culturally because we're so used to kind of, you know, kind of putting people in these boxes of, you know, I'm just dieting. I'm just trying to be thin. Everyone's just trying to be thin. And then if it gets really bad, then you're like, oh, like clinical eating disorder, that's bad. But there's a lot of gray area in between. In fact, I would argue most women certainly, and most people, you know, many people in our culture are kind of somewhere in that gray area where food is like a source of pain and struggle for them. And certainly their bodies and their body image is a source of pain and struggle for them. So I help folks really heal that relationship with food and their bodies. And yeah, that's sort of the gist of what I do and why I'm here. So thanks for letting me talk about that.
I mean, anything you want to talk about is fine with me.
Let's see where it goes.
When you say get crazy around food, like what does the crazy mean? Like, how do you define the craziness?
You know, it's interesting. I go back and forth about whether or not I want to keep using this word because I think it, you know, it can be used in a really problematic way, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, just in a derogatory way. But when I was really struggling with food, that's how I felt. And that's why I kind of have kept this tagline is like, for so many years of my life, I just felt totally nuts. Like there was something wrong with me around food. I have a little bit more of an extreme version of this story, which is probably part of my karma and why I teach this stuff now. You know, I was put on a diet when I was very, very young. I was put on my first diet when I was 3 years old at the hands of my pediatrician. I was like high on the baby BMI scale or whatever. And I was put on a low carb diet, which started this trend from basically at the time of birth of being feeling like restricted around food. Like I had to be careful about what I ate. Like my body wasn't trustworthy. I wasn't trustworthy. I had to, you know, sit on my hands trying not to eat. But what would end up happening inevitably, certainly when I was a child, and it actually just got worse and worse and worse as I aged into adulthood, was feelings of failure when I couldn't stick to the, you know, crazy diet that I was being put on. And this is the common experience of dieting, right? The common experience of trying to lose weight, trying to control your weight is not, oh, I lost weight and kept it off. This is great. The common experience is losing weight or at least attempting to lose weight, kind of like holding on by your knuckles, trying to like get your weight down or do everything you can to try to like maintain your body size into like whatever you think it should be, usually followed by some sort of rebound, feeling of shame, feeling of guilt. Oh man, I ate that thing. I shouldn't have eaten that thing, you know, and at the more extreme ends, I think for, you know, we've sort of normalized culturally that, yeah, you know, you try and, you know, sometimes you're going to mess up and whatever, but this is just how it is. You just got to keep trying and sometimes you'll mess up and you keep trying. As you kind of push out into that sort of spectrum farther and farther, this sort of cycle of up and down gets more and more intense. And that's certainly what happened to me as time went on. I would kind of go, okay, got to bear down, got to try and like get thin, you know, and try to control my weight. followed by some sort of what eventually turned into binge eating episodes, right? Just like, you know, oh my God, falling off the wagon, you know, can't hold myself back 1 second longer. Screw it. You know, I don't want one brownie. Give me the whole tray, you know, like just from feeling so deprived or like feeling so held back around food. You know, it's kind of like when you're dieting and you're trying not to eat and you're trying to lose weight, it's like you're really in a cage with food. Like at some point, that's what it kind of starts to feel like. And I mean, I think everyone can kind of understand that feeling of like, man, I want to eat that, but I shouldn't, right? That kind of tightness around food when you're restricting. But yeah, like if you go far enough down that path, you know, the chances of you being able to stick to it are really low. And the rebounds that happen get more and more intense. So I, again, starting from as young as I can remember, was sort of a classic diet binge cycler, right? Like I'd have periods of being in control of my food. Okay, got it. I'm going to do it this time. Followed by periods of really losing control and being like, screw it. I'm just going to eat everything, right? And this, when you kind of, again, kind of follow that line into its extremes, becomes binge eating disorder, right? That's what binge eating disorder is. It's a period of really intense restriction, basically clinically restrictive eating disorder style restriction, followed by massive binge eating episodes. And some folks don't necessarily recognize that they're restricting because restricting is so normalized in our culture, right? You go on Instagram, everyone's like trying to like kind of shred and eat paleo and this and that, and right, and whatever they're doing, people don't recognize that, you know, it is a really common, in fact, probability, like of likelihood that you, that folks are going to end up losing that and kind of losing that control and kind of having some sort of rebound eating episode or period of rebound weight gain, right? But when that happens, when you have these rebounds, you don't necessarily think that the dieting was the problem. You don't necessarily think that the culture telling you that you need to like squish your square peg of a body into the round hole society dictates for you, right? Like you don't necessarily recognize that as the problem. Most folks just think, what's wrong with me that I can't stick to it? I screwed up. I fucked up. That's how most people in our culture think of these rebound or binge eating episodes. Something must be wrong with me. Oftentimes binge eating episodes will happen when our willpower is worn down, which happens when we're stressed, when we're dealing with difficult emotions, right? So there's a lot of sense of like, oh, it's because, you know, this happened because I was stressed out or dealing with difficult emotions. And certainly there's like a component there, but, you know, quote unquote, emotional eating or binge eating at the hands, you know, of stress or difficult emotions almost always goes hand in hand with restriction as well. So yeah. So that's sort of, I think the crazy really is speaks to this feeling of what's wrong with me. Why can't I get this under control? Why am I failing at this? You know, feeling like out of control around food, right? Like I can't stop eating, which is what it feels like when you're in that rebound. It's like, what's wrong with me? There's something must be deeply, horribly wrong with me, especially in a culture that's constantly telling you that you should have control over your food. And that food is not a biological instinct. It's just a choice, right? Like this is the messaging that we get is that like what we put in my mouth is up to me. When in reality, there are actual like instincts, physiological instincts involved with this. So yeah, so that's sort of why I chose that word is, you know, I've gone back and forth of not using the word crazy because I don't want to kind of further problematize what I'm talking about. But that's how it felt to me when I was in it was like, there's something wrong with me. All the way to the point where I ended up at one point, you know, seeking various different forms of clinical treatment and in fact went to eating disorder rehab for this problem because it got so out of control on those sort of extreme ends of, you know, just spending all my time thinking about what am I going to eat? How am I going to keep my weight down? How am I going to get it under control this time? You know, and then of course, rebounding and like, you know, I call it like falling into a pile of brownie batter that I couldn't swim my way out of.
That's a visual. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this is happening. I mean, this is a common, totally normalized experience again on a spectrum, right? So, you know, I think it's very normal. People think it's very normal. Like, oh, I'm being good. And then I'm being bad, right? That's like the lowest, most normal version of this. But as you push out, as you go further, you know, into the, you know, out along that spectrum, those ups and downs get more and more intense. And more severe, and it's been more life consuming, right? You know, the energy that it takes to hold on to the diet becomes, it takes so much time, you know, it just takes mental energetic space. You know, it's like, I'd probably have like a PhD if I spent like half that time that I spent, you know, learning about nutrition, you know, in Barnes and Noble at the time or on the internet as it would be today. If I just put that effort towards literally any other pursuit, I'd be like a Mensa candidate, you know? But yeah, so like just spending so much time kind of focused on how do I control my food? How do I control my weight? I think we now use health oftentimes as a euphemism for weight, which is a conversation we can certainly have. I think that's a big, you know, kind of problem in the current wellness industry. And then of course, those binge eating episodes, those rebound binge episodes just are filled with so much shame and so much like hopelessness and feelings of failure. And, you know, that is kind of where this goes, you know, that like, oh, I'm being good, being bad, you know, that kind of happens sort of on that normalized side of the spectrum can really quickly turn into something really life sucking. And that's sort of eventually where it got for me. So yeah, sorry.
So what I'm hearing, it sounds like is, people are feeling discomfort around their weight or their body. And so they're going on to a diet. And then the diet, you said on your website, this interesting thing that binging is a symptom of dieting. Yeah. So it sounds like the calorie restrictions physiologically of dieting.
Or macronutrient restrictions too, okay. Right? I mean, that can be the case too. I mean, like if you're not getting a major macronutrient, fat, protein, carbohydrates, right? Yeah. If you're not getting major macronutrients that your body needs, you know, eventually you're probably going to rebel.
Gotcha. And then the rebellion is like the binging. So then the binging, then it sounds like induces some elements of shame in the individual whereby it's like, I'm a bad person. I'm insufficient. I'm not good enough. Right. And then it also sounds like it induces some elements of a lack of trust. Like I can't trust myself to do this thing,
right?
Which it sounds like then takes you a step deeper in the cycle. So then you're like, now I really need to do a diet. And then it just kind of perpetuates this dark cloud of suck.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it's like every time you fail at the diet, I mean, I think what's so kind of like diabolically brilliant about the diet industry is that like, it's the only product that gets sold where if it doesn't work, right, you feel like you must have done something wrong, right? Like I must have screwed it up because it didn't work for me. So I must have, you know, it's my failure, right? Mm-hmm. And so then it's like, okay, you know, it's almost like I don't trust myself and I feel like I have to double down in self-control. And a lot of times people are binging on typical things, you know, typical things that people binge on are typical things that people restrict. So like sugar would be a really good example of something where like, you know, a lot of folks who are dealing with this, they will eventually get to the point where they're like, where they start to identify as something like a sugar addict, right? You hear this a lot. Like I'm addicted to sugar. Once I start, I can't stop. And it's like, really what's going on is they're in that exact cycle, right? They're in that they restricted it. Then they binged on it. The binge makes us feel like we can't control ourselves around the thing. And then we go back to double down on the restriction even more intensely. Oh my God, now I have to abstain. I can never eat sugar. It's a drug, right? You know, all of this, right? And so it just kind of goes deeper and deeper and deeper into this like intense distrust of self around food and like disconnection from our actual needs and often hunger signals and all of that. And this feeling of like, I need like boundaries from the external world to control my food because I can't control it.
And that's that lack of trust element. Yeah. Like I don't trust myself to have this tray of brownies in my house. Like I'll eat them all.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. So this is sort of a big issue, I think, especially when you talk about like young girls and women who are kind of growing up with this. It's like, you know, for me, again, I started dieting technically when I was about 3. I never felt like I was trustworthy. Like I would look at my like little girlfriends and I'd be like, how is she just like leaving that brownie on her plate? How is she like having a bite of that and then just getting bored with it? Like that, I couldn't even fathom that. Like if I had brownies in front of me, it was like, I was either going to eat them all or I was sitting on my hands trying not to eat them. There was no ability to like self-regulate or self-moderate, which are things that we as humans are actually designed and able to do, right? There's nothing physiologically different between me and my little girl friends. The difference is that I was taught from a super young age that I couldn't trust myself. I was physically restrained from those foods that basically, I mean, I call it diet-related trauma, right? If you want to look at this through the through a trauma-informed lens, you can, right? So I was restrained from eating certain foods. That's pretty violent on the body, right? To like cut out carbohydrates on a child as an example, right? I mean, this is really, it's violent. I mean, it's starvation. It's really, I think that people really underestimate how physically violent dieting really is on the body, especially when you start to get into things like cutting out major macronutrients that our bodies need to survive, right? And so this is a trauma that I experienced, which of course, the outcome of that trauma is me going to be having extreme attachment to that food and extreme feelings of like wanting to hoard that food and feeling like, you know, I need to, you know, get it all in as soon as I possibly can, because who knows like when it's going to get taken away from me in the future. And this is something that, you know, as adults, we have the same experience. It's just self-imposed. It's self-inflicted injury. That's basically what dieting is, in my opinion, right? It is self-inflicted kind of starvation, which it sounds like a dramatic word. Like people often say, well, I don't starve myself. I'm not doing that. But the definition of starvation gets really weird once you start cutting out food groups or once you start limiting calories intentionally for the purpose of going into your fat stores, which is what happens when you, by definition, don't have enough food. You know, it starts to get tricky what the definition of starvation is once you're in diet world. Does that kind of question ring? Something's coming up for you?
It reminds me of airplanes. So years ago, I had this realization. I was on a flight and we took off and we were maybe a foot off the ground. And I was like, oh, we're flying. Like, yeah, we're only a foot off the ground, but the airplane is in flight. We are flying. And so from this, it sounds like starving is also along a spectrum. So the first day that you maybe don't eat some carbs or you don't get your macronutrients, it's like the starvation process has begun in the same way that the flight begins a foot off the ground.
Exactly. Basically, right? Exactly. It's like anytime you're going into nutritional deficit, right? Like any kind of nutritional deficit that's sort of less than what your body needs, which you could argue the definition of that starts at when your body is losing weight, right? When you are going into your fat reserves because you don't have enough food, right? Like, so this is, I mean, you know, chronic attempts at weight loss are basically chronic attempts at self-starvation.
That's interesting. And then how do you distinguish between this phrase of emotional eating, which I've heard pretty often of like a, it sounds like a self-soothing thing versus the binge eating.
This is one of my favorite questions.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, this is like a core concept, right? This is a core concept. So basically, you know, my definition, and these aren't, you know, there's no major public consensus about this. This is the definitions that I use that I think are actually most useful and effective in terms of dealing with these issues in a practical way. My definition of binge eating is eating in reaction to restriction, right? It's the rebellion after a period of deprivation. It's, you know, I'm pulling the bow back as far as I possibly can, tight, trying not to let go, and then let go, and it just flies in the other direction in proportion to how far I pulled the bow back, right? It's like, you know, I call it diet binge cycling physics. Like the more I restrict myself, the more I starve myself effectively, the more I try to control myself around food, you know, if the word starve doesn't resonate, because it often doesn't, you know, in our culture, the more I try to control myself around food, the more loss of control I'm going to experience the second I let go. So that's sort of in a nutshell what binge eating is. It is a reaction to dieting by definition. It, by this definition, doesn't exist outside of the context of some sort of initial diet, initial restriction, or initial attempt at food control. Emotional eating, on the other hand, is just eating to soothe a feeling. Like I'm sad, I'm lonely, I'm, you know, whatever. Food is a sensory pleasure, like sex or touch, right? And that feels good, right? Like I'd like to just have a nice feeling to help me, you know, kind of move through whatever is going on in my life. And emotional eating is, it's interesting because I actually kind of take the position that, you know, emotional eating is kind of not that bad as a coping mechanism. You know, like what's really wrong with emotional eating? Like outside of the context of like rampant cultural fat phobia and body shame, is emotional eating that big of a deal? Like on the spectrum of coping mechanisms, how big of a problem is this if we weren't culturally obsessed with thinness, right? Mm. So and that's even sort of like, my kind of...
yeah, I was thinking like eating in general, like a good meal, I would mm-hmm. argue, requires an emotional sensory experience, right?
Exactly. There's this other argument that like all eating is emotional to some extent. Can you really make a distinction between like emotional eating and not, is there such a thing as non-emotional eating, right? Is there such right. a thing as, you know, food that isn't, you know, that doesn't comfort you and to some extent, that doesn't give you pleasure, that doesn't bring you some kind of, you know, non-physical nourishment. I mean, similarly to sex, right? One of my favorite quotes, and I don't even know where it came from. I should probably figure this out, is, you know, eating just for fuel is like having sex just for reproduction. You know, and eating, you know, it's just like not really a thing, you know, like yeah. culturally, it's never been a thing for thousands and thousands of years. We have rituals around eating and eating brings people together. And we put energy and effort into making food pleasurable. And this is not new. This is not something that's new as of the industrial agriculture movement that I think people like to blame, you know, delicious, mm-hmm. pleasurable food on for since the beginning of time, this has been the case. Right. So I think, you know, the emotional eating is highly villainized in diet culture, right? In a culture that's obsessed with thinness, emotional eating is highly villainized. And that actually causes and can contribute to and exacerbates binge eating, right? Because, you know, if I'm, you know, wanting some comfort and just feeling like I need something, but I'm like, oh, but I shouldn't because I'm, you know, trying to be on my diet or I'm trying to be good or I'm trying to whatever. You know, now all of a sudden, oh man, I screwed up. I fell off the wagon. Well, I might as well finish the pan and then tomorrow I'll jump back on the wagon.
Right. Right?
So it's like emotional and binge eating, they can kind of have a relationship together, right? They can kind of, one can kind of, emotional eating often turns into binge eating in a diet culture.
Right. And they even yeah. manifest in the language use. So for example, a cheat day implies mm-hmm. that you're doing something naughty and terrible by eating food that's quote unquote bad.
Right. Right.
And so it's ingrained in this kind of cultural lexicon. Yeah.
Diet culture. We live in an aggressive, hardcore diet culture.
Right.
It is, I mean, even for professionals who are eating disorder informed, it's so embedded in our language that it's like it takes time to actually relearn how to talk about food in a food positive way. Mm. Where we're not like villainizing and making food wrong, right? That's another way of thinking about body positivity. You know, if you kind of are really kind of focused on the food sort of eating disorder recovery aspects of this, we talk about food positivity, right? Where no foods are good or bad. Some foods have more nutrition, different nutritional properties than other foods, right? Some foods are more focused on sensory pleasure. Some foods are more focused on, you know, how it's going to make my body feel. All foods have different properties, but there's no food that's like inherently wrong or bad, right? Like moralizing food is just a setup for making people feel like shit about themselves. So it's not useful, you know? Like,
that's interesting. So how do you balance that with the obvious alternative argument, which is like broccoli sprouts are more healthy than chicken McNuggets from McDonald's? You know what I mean? It's like,
right. So like, I would argue, right. And again, so healthy, I mean, it sort of depends on how you're defining health, right? So, you know, again, it kind of calls into question, like, what is health?
Right.
What does that mean? You know, I would say like broccoli and sprouts have a lot more fiber. They have a lot more, you know, like kind of green micronutrients in them, which, you know, alkalize our blood and do all sorts of like great things for our bodies. They give us energy. Like I love broccoli and sprouts for doing those things. And there are all sorts of reasons why on certain occasions, having some like chocolate might actually be the healthy choice. Like maybe I, you know, really just do want to like share some chocolate with my lover, or, you know, maybe I want to have that like sensory experience and it gives me pleasure and joy. Or another example that I give all the time, that's just an easy example that might not relate to everyone in this audience, but is something to just think about is, you know, if you're, you know, struggling with a clinical eating disorder or you're underweight for whatever reason, broccoli and sprouts are taking up room in your stomach that actually help keep you from regaining your weight and can be dangerous for you. Right. So this is like super high fibrous foods like that, you know, in large quantities can actually be problematic if, you know, you're undernourished or malnourished. Right. So it's like contextual, like the whole context of what's a healthy food totally depends on the situation you're in and what's going on.
Okay. So Isabel.
Yeah.
We've decided that there is a pernicious, cyclical, culturally infested thing in which all of us are swimming around in. And we've decided that health is an amorphous, vague idea. And that sometimes broccoli sprouts are not as nutritiously necessary as alternatives. So like, how does one begin to escape this paradigm? Like, how does one move towards a, what did you say, food positive, self-respecting, self-trusting, I honor my body, I'm not in scarcity. Like, how do we escape?
Well, so number one is just noticing how you do moralize foods rather than talking about them just kind of objectively and factually for the properties that they hold, right? Like broccoli isn't like the holy grail. It's not like just some like godly food. It just has a lot of fiber and has like good green stuff, which we love, which make our bodies feel good. And that serves us in one particular way.
It's like, it's not good or bad. It's just broccoli.
Yeah. It's just broccoli. Like it does certain things. Those things are really helpful. There are a lot of people in our country, you know, in the United States and in the US, there's a lot of people in the US who don't have access to broccoli. And that's really sad, you know, like.
Or it upsets their stomach or something. Like,
yeah. Like I want folks to be able to get access to broccoli. Yeah. There's so many different ways, like so many different reasons why like broccoli is such a privilege. Like broccoli is awesome. Like I think there's some sort of like, I think people sometimes hear about the anti-diet movement and they think we're attacking broccoli. And I'm like, no, I love broccoli. Broccoli is like one of my favorite things for so many reasons. And there's also like a really important place in my life for chocolate. You know, there really is at least at this point in my life, you know? And so we'll see how long that continues. But for me, it's like, I love having, you know, for me, having like my almond milk cappuccino with sugar in it, like that just is, that like brings joy to my morning that is just worth it for me, you know? Like, I think there's also like a personal choice aspect of this too, right? Being able to have like autonomous, independent, like decision-making about what's worth it for me and starting to think about food as something not just about, you know, the sort of machine mechanical health complex views my body, but starting to think about food as something that does have pleasure properties and has mental health properties and kind of spiritual properties beyond just what it does to my blood sugar or whatever, you know, joy is so important. Kind of just like looping back also to the emotional eating conversation, you know, if I feel like I'm in a box with food and if I feel like I'm not supposed to eat certain things, we also know that not just binge eating is a potential outcome, but emotional eating increases. It's like the more restrained I feel around food, the more more likely I am to quote unquote turn to food for comfort and soothing as well. And, you know, it's a little bit unclear why those reasons are, but I would imagine a lot of it does have to do with kind of the trauma of feeling like I can't just relax around food. Like food is this life-giving source and I have to feel anxious and tight around it all the time. Like, oh, God forbid, you know, I eat the wrong thing. It's like a landmine. And it's going to like blow up in my face. Our birthright is to feel relaxed around food. You know, like that's really, you could argue, I call it sanity around food. Like I help women just have feel sane around food, feel comfortable around food, feel like they can relax around. So many women don't feel that way. They feel like they have to just be really careful around food all the time or something really bad's going to happen to them. And usually bad, what they actually are concerned. Sometimes people are, there's a lot of increasing levels of health related anxiety and like kind of health related phobias coming up in the wellness industry. But a lot of it is just, you know, fear of fatness and just, you know, kind of like hysteria about how I'm going to be perceived and my worth, especially for women.
Would just a clarification, would a health related anxiety, like, is that like, oh, it's not organic, I can't eat that? Is it the other, what is an example of that?
Well, so like a health-related anxiety, like, so if we're using the term anxiety specifically to mean kind of like a hyper focus on something being dangerous, that may be disproportionate to the danger that actually is presenting.
So right? it's just a piece of chocolate, chill out.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to kill you.
Exactly. Like the fastest growing clinical eating disorder that we're seeing is something called orthorexia, right? So a lot of people know what anorexia is or bulimia is. Orthorexia is, you know, basically phobia of quote unquote unhealthy foods, or like kind of aggressive anxiety about health when it comes to food. Like, you know, I remember at one point in my life, you know, having like a panic attack because I went to a dinner party and like they were serving farm raised salmon, you know? And at that point I was like, farm raised salmon, you know, I'd read some statistic about farm raised salmon, and it just like, I felt like I could feel that anxiety in my body about eating this farm raised salmon. Now we can have a conversation about the issues with farm raised salmon. They're easy to Google, you know, like that's something that's available. But at the end of the day, the stress in my body that I experienced because they were serving a type of salmon that I don't think, right? It was probably a disproportionate response at the time, you know, not being able to like eat at a dinner party calmly because they're serving the wrong food or serving food that I'm scared of. That stress is probably more problematic for my body in the long run, especially if it's happening chronically with different foods on a regular basis.
Gotcha.
Than just eating the salmon, you know?
And then on the other side of that, because I know on your website, there was a few references to people feeling anxious about going out to eat because they might eat everything on the table, or they didn't trust themselves to, you know, be presentable or respectable. Right. And so it sounds like they're two sides of the same coin there, whereby there's a, not a dysfunction, but there's like the relationship between food and body is kind of hit this inflection point. It's like,
totally. So like another, you could argue that all disordered eating really boils down to some kind of fear of food, some sort of anxiety around food, some sort of distrust, some sort of feeling like, you know, either I won't be able to control myself around it, or, you know, the food's going to pop out of the bushes and I'm going to eat it and all hell's going to break loose, right? Like there's this feel like it's like, there's this feeling of if I eat the wrong thing and I don't totally trust myself not to eat the wrong thing. So I have to be hypervigilant and super careful because if I, you know, make a wrong move, I could end up, you know, eating like these bad things will happen to me because of things that I ate, right? There's sort of this sense of food is dangerous. Like, I think it's like a landmine that like it might blow up at any moment, whether that be, you know, I'm going to go to a restaurant and there won't be anything safe for me to eat, right? And then, you know, God forbid I take a bite of the white flour, it's over for me. And then I just, I'm going to binge my face off and then diet starts tomorrow, right? That's one way that this landmine could explode. Another way could literally just be, again, anxiety of there's nothing for me to eat and then I won't be able to eat. And then people are going to think I'm weird because I'm not eating. But if I eat it, I'm going to have the health anxiety or whatever, right? There's so many different permutations of this anxiety around food. But you could kind of argue that that's, you know, sort of the definition of disordered eating is sort of fear of food, is sort of anxiety around food, is this feeling of like tightness, like food needs to be controlled all the time or bad things are going to happen to me, whether that be weight gain, AKA my value, my self-esteem, my lovability, if you equate weight gain and lovability and self-esteem and self-value, or health related stuff is kind of it's a growing trend is the health related stuff, but still the vast majority of it is fat phobia.
Right. And so then what is the relationship between loving or hating your body and the everything you've just talked about here? Like, is that the root of it?
It is a major, major part of the equation. And it is the root of it for a good portion of the population.
I guess I'm trying to think in the perspective of like, how do we escape this cyclical demon? Like, where does one begin to explore?
If we didn't live in a fat phobic culture, I think we would see a reduction in eating disordered behavior by about 90 to 95%. Like, that's how significant it is. But again, it's sort of when you think about like the root of it, that's kind of also a complicated question because, you know, like if you are a person who associates thinness with love and who associates thinness with self-worth and self-value, you might project all of your lovability wounds onto your body, right? So like, for example, if you grow up in a house where you were neglected or traumatized or didn't get the love that you need, you're significantly more likely to become obsessed with trying to be thin, especially as you are a woman, because you see that as a path to getting that love back, right? So it sort of depends on what your definition of the root issue is, because yes, fat phobia, if fat phobia didn't exist, this kind of goes away, because then thinness no longer is the path to love and acceptance and self-worth.
Right.
But in a world where thinness is the path to self-love, you know, and self-value and self-worth and all these things, or at least it's perceived to be, right? In that world, somebody who has trauma and lovability wounds is much more likely to become obsessed with thinness as a path to getting those things, right? Because we think, well, this is something I can control. I just control what I eat and then I'll get thin and then everyone will love me and I'll find the perfect partner and everything will be great, right? So it's like we use dieting as often as a way of dealing with deeper stuff. But the only reason we use dieting as a way of dealing with the deeper stuff is because weight stigma does exist and fat phobia is real in our culture. And that is a thing, right? So it seems like an easy path to get there, even though it rarely works. And by the way, even if you were in this very small percentage of people who are able to maintain long-term weight suppression, it still doesn't fix your lovability wounds at the end of the day, right? This is the issue.
Have you seen any research that attempts to correlate trauma and obesity?
Like, trauma is not correlated with fatness.
Yeah, I guess
trauma is correlated with eating disorders.
Eating disorders.
Okay. There's a ton of research around that. Trauma is absolutely correlated with eating disorders, but eating disorders are not correlated with weight.
Right.
You can have an eating disorder at any weight.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. So you were expressing that people who are seeking love, validation, worthiness, belonging, as a consequence of their weight, are then more likely to have anxiety around food and dieting, which, because of that cyclical nature, it seems like it will increase the anxiety, lack of self-worth, lack of self-love,
right,
et cetera. And it just kind of perpetuates.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't need to even be a fat person to think that the pursuit of thinness will save you. I mean, you could be a size 4. You could look like a model and still think, and if you have lovability wounds and still think that getting thinner is going to get you there, right? Just because of how extreme the thin ideal is, you know, like when you look at like the Kendall Jenner, like the ideal model of what a woman's body should look like is so like in that one percentile, it really doesn't matter what your starting weight is. You feel like you're going to get more love if you get closer to that. Right. Gotcha. So you could start as like a super conventionally attractive, you know, thin woman, and you could be a size 4, which is tiny, like super high on the thin privilege spectrum. But if you have lovability wounds, or, you know, it's very likely, you know, you might feel like my best option for increasing my love is getting closer to that Kendall Jenner size.
Right. It's this perpetual chasing of enoughness.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of trauma and its correlation to eating disorders, like it really doesn't matter what your starting weight is, or, you know, that's not really relevant. I mean, I think that, and this is speculative. This is not something I've seen data on. So in terms of like the relationship of trauma and eating disorders, we see that at all sizes of the size spectrum. It doesn't really matter, you know, whether somebody starts thin or fat or, but what I will say is, you know, so what I'm about to say is speculative. This I don't know, but, you know, if you are, you know, kind of like, I use the word fat rather than the word overweight. This is a word that, you know, most of the folks in my community prefer that I use, so I use it. But if you're a larger bodied person, right, you are more likely to be censured, obviously, for your weight, you know, in various ways, right? So, you know, it's obviously possible that you're going to be kind of pushed further into the cycle harder than somebody who's conventionally thin, or, you know, somebody who's normatively thin. But I don't think there's really any, but I haven't seen any specific numbers saying that fat folks are more likely to get pushed into that cycle than thin folks. But it wouldn't surprise me if those numbers were getting higher, especially because of the kind of increasingly aggressive levels of institutional discrimination and institutional censure that fat people are, you know, facing more and more as time goes on and as the war on obesity gets more intense.
Yeah, yeah. Just yikes. It's such a rabbit hole. And I think it's,
yeah.
I just think it's worth noting that the language that we use here in terms of like fat and overweight and all of it is like, I'm way outside my pay grade. So if I am to those listening, like if I am misspeaking, if we are misspeaking, like it is all done with the intention of compassion and love and trying to understand. And I apologize if anything I've said.
Totally. You like, are totally forgiven. This is great, like, education. I always like to explain also why I use the word fat, because so many people think that that it's an insult, right? So many people think that fat's the bad word, that fat's a derogatory term. So I often, you know, I wouldn't have even called it out that I was using that word if I wasn't nervous that somebody was going to think that I was using it in a derogatory way.
Well, that's
because that's culturally how we see it.
Right. It goes back to that broccoli is just broccoli. It's like broccoli's not good or bad. Yes. It's like, it's just fat. It's not good or bad.
It's like tall or short, you know?
In our culture though, in our society, we have agreed upon this norm whereby fat equals less good, right?
Yes. Exactly.
And so what you're doing, it sounds like, is reclaiming that word as like, it's not a bad thing to be fat. It's like, you're fat. It's like, I'm fat, he's fat. It's a
tall,
it's a
short,
thing.
Blonde, brown. Yeah,
it's exactly. It's not a morality descriptor. It's just a physical description.
Exactly. It's just a physical description. So the fat positive movement, you know, is really like attempting to reclaim. I am conscious when I talk to folks who may not be super familiar with that movement, who might not identify with that movement, I'll often say like larger bodied. The term overweight, I think the issue with it and the reason why a lot of people in the fat activist movement or the body positive movement are kind of trying to move away from that word is the word overweight implies, right, that there's a weight that you are over. That's not okay, right? Like, you know, like that there's a line in the sand and now you're above it and that's a problem, right? And so, it also, once you get into overweight and obesity also would be sort of like the next like word that I choose not to use to out of respect for the community. You know, these are terms that really medicalize and pathologize fatness, right? They're turning fatness into a problem to solve rather than just as a descriptor, like you said, moral descriptor, this is what my body looks like.
And it's even underweight as well. So it goes both ways, as if there's this ideal that you're not meeting. And so because you're not meeting this ideal that itself is not fully agreed upon by anyone, that's bad.
Underweight is so complicated because the definitions medically of under and overweight have moved down. Like politically, like just in terms of like, if you asked a doctor 50 years ago what the definition of underweight is, it would be different than what it is today. So, you know, in sort of the medical community, the ideal body size is going down and down and down. And the reasons for this are quite unscientific. I think the medical community seems to think that, you know, if you get people scared that they might be going into the overweight category, then they'll diet more, right? And you can kind of shame people into you can shame away the obesity epidemic. It hasn't worked, but yeah, you know, even before, I think it was in the early 90s, the definition of, you know, that sort of healthy BMI range actually jumped down. So we are now in a place where, you know, it's an incredibly small percentage of the population that is considered underweight, like 1% or something very, very, very low. And, you know, occasionally I will use the term underweight in a different way, not to reference those kind of statistical medical numbers, but, you know, under the weight that your body wants to be. Right? Like if your body wants to be a certain size, and that's like your sort of genetic you know, predisposition, because genetics do play a role. They play a huge role. I don't know why people, this is just like, we know this from science, right? As much as people would like to pretend that that's not a thing, you know, if your body is under the size that it wants to be, even if it's in the healthy BMI range, you are underweight for you, right? And a lot of dieters right now are underweight for them, right? And that's a problem, right? You know, you have folks who are just genetically inclined to be bigger, who are basically being pushed by the medical community into this healthy BMI range that really isn't designed for them. So they are being pushed by doctors to basically be underweight for them, right? They have to eat starvation levels of diet, of nutrition in order to maintain this quote unquote healthy weight. That's not cool. You know, like there are people who would have to eat 1,000 calories a day to look like, you know, a normatively thin person. That's starvation. That's not okay. You know?
Like ironically, they would need to live a life with more suffering in order to be healthy.
Healthy.
Right. Quote unquote healthy. Okay.
Healthy,
so
according to this BS BMI. Yeah.
So, all right, Isabel, and we've got maybe 10, 15 minutes left planned. When, like when a client comes, 'cause I know you work with loads of women, you've got a decade of experience. Like when people come to you, like, where do you suggest they begin to explore this topic or begin to make some shifts?
So the very, very first like basic thing that we didn't even really get into, but it's like, if you have been dieting your whole life, which basically means you've been taking your food cues from outside of you, right? You've been eating what, you know, Dr. Oz tells you to eat instead of what feels good to you intuitively, right? Or whatever, it could be any wellness person. The first step is actually just reconnecting with your body and starting to listen to your body, being like, okay, if I just like shut out all the rules, if I just got rid of all the rules and just got rid of all the noise from the wellness industry and actually just started reconnecting with what my body wants, which might be different than what my brain thinks it should eat or what my brain is telling me is bad to eat or good to eat or whatever, right? If I just actually reconnect with like what feels good to eat in my body, what is my body craving and asking for right now? That's sort of step one. You know, the first thing that dieting does is it disconnects us from our bodies, right? Like fundamentally disconnects us from a core biological process in our bodies, hunger, fullness, satiation, you know, these things. We're not supposed to deny these things. So the first step is literally just like, I wonder what my body wants to eat. I wonder what my animal, my physical animal, human animal is actually asking for, rather than just trying to like follow what's on the sheet or the blog post or the whatever. Right. And so that's kind of like the first step of getting out of dieting is, if I put the rules away, what does my body actually want? This is where people start to get really nervous because, again, if you have diet related trauma or you've been diet cycling your whole life, you might think, well, all I want is brownies, right? Or all I want is whatever. Pretty quickly, right, into just eating brownies all day, you're going to not feel that good. And your body is probably going to be like, this doesn't work. Right? If, again, if you're feeling into what your body really wants, you're going to start to feel like, oh yeah, my body doesn't want to eat brownies all day. That feels crappy. Right. And so you might expand, right? It doesn't mean never eat brownies again, but maybe I diversify into some broccoli or some sprouts or some proteiny things or fat things or whatever, right? Generally speaking, our bodies are going to call for all the major macronutrients in some kind of combination. So fruits, vegetables, meat, starch, protein, right? I mean, literally it's like everything you ever needed to know about nutrition you learned in kindergarten, you know, like basic meal. Like you went to a restaurant and ordered an entree, what would be on it? Some kind of protein, some kind of starch, some kind of veg, some kind of fat. Easy peasy, right? So again, you can listen for it, right? This is really about reconnecting with yourself and reconnecting with your just physical cravings, desires, needs, and noticing what's going on in your brain. What's your brain telling you what you want? What does your body actually like feel like it needs physically? And that's kind of step one. But that you know, I think the challenge here, right? What makes this difficult is your brain in diet culture, in a land where you probably have fears around weight gain and fears about losing control and fear, right? Your brain's going to go crazy. I mean, if you struggle with this, which people do on the spectrum, right? Your brain's probably going to go crazy being like, I can't believe you ate that, right? Or whatever. Try to control. Your brain does not like to lose control. Your brain wants to stay in control. So that's like the hard thing, is like giving up all the rules is actually harder than you think. I mean, people, I think they think emotional eating is their problem. They're like, oh, I'm so dependent on food to comfort myself. I'm like, try giving up dieting. That shit's really hard. You're going to freak out. So I mean, this is a much bigger conversation, but in terms of just like step one, like what is the beginning thing to think about, you know, is this sort of idea of reconnecting with what my body wants to eat rather than like what the noise out there or what's going on in my brain that's telling me what to eat. And there's a term for this. It's called intuitive eating. Very common, right? This is sort of the big major buzzword in the anti-diet world, intuitive eating. And that's sort of the idea of intuitive eating, or the tool of intuitive eating, is really this, right? It's this idea of eating what my body wants to eat rather than what like the outside world is telling me to eat, or what like my diet brain thinks that I should be eating.
Yeah. And I think it may be helpful to have like a giant asterisk/caveat, which is like, it's not as easy as it sounds to connect with your body. And it's a process, and it takes practice and devotion, and it will be a work of a lifetime, let's say.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Actually, it totally fair, because again, we live in a culture that is constantly disconnected. I like to think I popped out of the womb very connected to my body.
Yeah.
But I spent at least 20 years actively disrupting that connection. So it's going to take some time to rebuild it, you know? Right. So I think that that's very, very fair. What I will say in terms of this being like a lifetime process is that food is actually a really great practice ground for reconnecting with my body in other ways. Like learning about like my hunger and my fullness signals and like what my body wants to eat physically is like a really, like, I think of that as like kind of like level one, level two, level three. Reconnecting with like my deep feelings and like my emotions, that's like level 6, 7, 8, right? So in some ways, this is actually like kind of an exercise in learning how to connect with your body on the really big, deep stuff. Because, you know, your hunger signals, not always, sometimes they can be, you know, very, very subtle. And this is certainly not an easy thing that I'm explaining. But for me, like, I feel like the greatest thing I got about moving into the intuitive eating journey was like, it was like kind of preparation for me doing that deeper body connection work in my emotional life later on. Like, I feel like I was able to go, I really got it when therapists started talking to me about feeling into my body and feeling my feelings in my body and doing somatic work. That made sense to me after having gone through like intuitive eating and diet recovery.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Because yeah, when you talk about trauma being stored in the body, and you talk about Gabor Mate's work and Peter Levine and Bessel van der Kolk and all these people, it's like, it's a thing, and it's a big thing. And for many of us who have been disconnected from our gut or our intuition for many, many years, when you say things like, oh, just listen to your intuition, it's like, man, that little fucker has been silent for 2 decades or 5 decades, or I don't even know what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I like the idea of using food and diet as kind of a daily practice to begin that journey, so to speak.
Exactly. It's like, it can be used as an exercise that grows the muscle of self-connection.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Isabel, you've kind of blown my brain a little bit. And now I'm like, oh gosh, I want to interview a dozen experts in all of these things. I think it'd be fascinating.
There's a ton of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is maybe. It is a rabbit hole, I will say. It is a rabbit hole.
Yeah. After we stop, I might have you email me some suggestions, if that's cool.
Well, but, definitely will.
For those listening that have made it through and they're like, man, love this chick. She's putting out some good stuff. Where can they find you? How do they get in your world?
So stopfightingfood.com is like my free, I have a free video training series that kind of just goes through my, you know, core concepts. Basically, I think that you referenced the trailer. It's really beautiful. Like it's just gorgeously shot and I had so much fun doing it. I think that's like the best place to start. So that's at stopfightingfood.com. And then also like, I'm kind of old school in this way, but people love my blogs and my emails, like my email newsletter. I just send out really good, very short, easy, consumable blog posts about these topics. And that's the primary way that I communicate with people, much more so than social. Although I don't know, maybe that will change in the future. But IsabelFoxandDuke.com and StopFightingFood.com. You know, if you want just like a little weekly body positive diet recovery inspo in your inbox, that's what's up.
A little snack.
Yeah, a little snack, like a little inbox snack.
A little healthy treat.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, thank you again. This was really wonderful and has definitely opened my eyes and heart and body to a variety of ideas. And I thank you for the work you're doing. And I think it's important.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good one.
That's it. There you have it. That was Isabel Fox and Duke. And as mentioned, I've included links in the show notes to her website, which has a whole bunch of free videos all about this topic, all about this conversation that we just had. So you can check those out. You can follow her on Instagram at Isabel Fox and Duke. And that's it. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And again, thanks for sharing, spreading the word, sending this to people that you love and care about and really think that they should know more about this topic. All of that is very helpful. It helps to spread the word. It helps to increase the impact, helps to raise the vibe of the collective consciousness. And that's what we're here to do. So thank you for being here, and I appreciate you, and I will talk to you soon.